This evening we begin our 23rd series, which is quite an innings, Mirz Hashem and counting. And yet, amazingly, there is still what to say. In fact, every year there is more and more what to say, it seems. But we'll know how to look. It's actually before we discuss or address our remarks to Parshas Noach. It is Erev Rosh Chodesh Mar Cheshvan, and I wanted to devote just a few moments to Mar Cheshvan, because there is actually a very famous comment. It's made the rounds, I think everyone knows it, which is all the more reason to perhaps inspect it and see whether it's unanimously agreed upon. In the background, firstly, before we get to the specific name of Mar Cheshvan, the background to the names of the months as we have them is itself very interesting and very important. The Torah, that is to say the Chumash, does not give names to any months. On the contrary, it refers to them only by number. And as surely as in Hebrew we're comfortable by saying Yom Rishon, Sheni, Shlishi, we don't feel deprived if the days of the week do not have names, we're fine for them to be numbers. So too in the Torah, as we know, the months are simply numbered, Chodesh HaRishon, Chodesh HaShvi'i, and of course they're numbered from Nisan. The institution, or the notion of giving names to months, certainly to all the names, to all the months, is much, much later. In fact, it followed us back from Bavel, from Golos Bavel, literally. And the background to this is that, as the Ramban explains, there's actually value. There is a value in referring both to the days by number and the months by number. It's not merely an easier way to catalog them. Because the reason why they have a number is an expression of the fact that you're counting towards something. They are a number in a certain process. And what that means is when we call Sunday Yom Rishon, according to the Ramban, that's actually part of the mitzvah of remembering Shabbos, because you always say, where are we? We say Shabbos, we're the first day of the week, the fourth day. At the end of Shacharis, we even say Hayom Rishon B'Shabbos, although Shabbos there means the week. But the Ramban says that calling the days by numbers is the fulfillment of remembering where we are vis-a-vis Shabbos, which means that it's actually, in Jewish terms, preferable to call it Yom Rishon than it is to call it Sunday. It's aside from the origins of all those names of Sunday and Monday and all of those. And the same is true, says Ramban, with regards to the numbers of the months. The Torah says that Nisan, what we call Nisan, is Chodesh HaRishon. And why is it Chodesh HaRishon? Because this is the first month. This is the month of our birth as a nation. It's part of remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim. What days are to remembering Shabbos, months are to remembering Yetzias Mitzrayim, and therefore it's a Jewish thing to do to call Tishrei Chodesh HaShvi'i, because that means it's the seventh month from Yetzias Mitzrayim. Every time you mention the number, you're keeping track vis-a-vis that important date. Having said that, although the days remain as they are, Yom Rishon, Sheni, Shlishi, but when it comes to the months, they underwent a change. And that change took place, as we said, at the end of Golos Bavel. The Yerushalmi tells us in Maseches Rosh Hashanah that these are Babylonian names or Persian names. And why? So the Ramban says, this is in fulfillment of the Nevuah of Yirmiyahu. Yirmiyah says, it's a famous pasuk, he says, in the future, there will become a time, lo velo ye'amer, and it will not be said anymore, Chai Hashem Asher Hotzi Es Bnei Yisrael Me'eretz Mitzrayim. We will no longer refer to Hashem as the one who took us out of Mitzrayim. That will be superseded by Chai Hashem Asher He'elos Me'eretz HaTzofon, which is Bavel. The approach to Bavel is from the north. Bavel itself is not in the north, but the approach to Bavel from Eretz Yisrael is from the north, and therefore it's always referred to as the north. And this was done. When was this superseding? What form did it take? It took the form of the months no longer being called by numbers, which is Zeichet Yetzias Mitzrayim, but rather by names, and these are Babylonian names, which remind us that we were in Bavel, and then came out. So that's a very interesting understanding of the shift from numbers to names. What's also interesting, just in terms of the psukim, is that there is a certain point in Tanakh where we find both. And it should be quite familiar to us. And that is Megillas Esther. Every month that is mentioned in Esther is mentioned both by number and by name. Not all the months are mentioned. Four or five of them are Chodesh HaRishon, Hu Chodesh Nisan, Chodesh Nimasar, Hu Chodesh Adar. What then is the meaning behind referring to them both by name and by number, says Ramban, very simply. The Megillas Esther was written at the end of Golos Bavel. This is when the transition was taking place. And therefore, every time it says, B'chodesh Nemasar, Chodesh Adar, what it means to say is, the month that has been known until now as Chodesh Adar, but from this point on will be known as Chodesh Adar. The month that heretofore was Chodesh HaRishon, henceforth will be Chodesh Nisan. And that you see almost like the kissing point between the numbers and the names as one took over from the other. That's where it's the changing of the guard, to borrow the expression. So with that background to the names of the months in general, we come now to Mar Cheshvan. And there is a well-known idea that circulates, and that is that the name of the month is actually Cheshvan, just Cheshvan. Why is it called Mar Cheshvan? Mar means bitter. What's bitter about Cheshvan? What's bitter about it is that it doesn't really have anything significant in it. There's no much distinction from one Rosh Chodesh to the other. It's just day by day. As opposed to in each month's own way, which has a special day, Cheshvan is lacking those days, and thus it is called Mar Cheshvan, bitter Cheshvan. We should say parenthetically that the implications of this statement is that the months that of Teves, for example, or Tammuz, where the days of distinction are actually days of mourning. What do they have going for them in the middle? Fast days, Asar B'Teves, Shivasar B'Tammuz. Somehow that's looked upon as a more positive month than Cheshvan. Perhaps at least something is happening. And perhaps it's with a vision for the future that all these days will in turn become Yamim Tovim, Soma Chamishi, Betzoma Asiri, Yule B'nei Yisrael, Le-Sosan U-Le-Simcha. And therefore, perhaps that's why we look upon those events at least as something that will launch a positive day. Okay, having said that, and it's worthwhile mentioning, the B'nai Sosra, the classic Hasidic work, quotes a Medrash, which states that in the future, the building of the third Beis HaMikdash will happen in the month of Cheshvan, which means although there's no inkling of any special days now, but it will yet enjoy its time in the sun. In the future, Cheshvan will be the month where the third Beis HaMikdash will be built. But getting back to where we are, there are no special days in Cheshvan, and hence Mar Cheshvan. Now, there is no at least to the best of my knowledge, no known source or authority who backs this idea. It's something that people say. There are a number of indications that this is not the case, as if to say that Mar Cheshvan actually is the name of the month. It's called Mar Cheshvan. It starts with a mem, just because that's the name of the month, just like Tammuz starts with a taf. It then became looked upon because Mar has that association and then was split into two. But in fact, Mar Cheshvan is the name of the month. The earlier sources that we have that record the month of Mar Cheshvan, the Mishnah for us is the earliest place that we'll find it, calls it Mar Cheshvan. It's never called Cheshvan by itself, or it's never called Mar Cheshvan with two in two words. So it's quite likely that in fact Mar Cheshvan really is one word, even though many people look upon it as two words, and in fact they'll just call it then Cheshvan, because they're on second name terms with the month. If Mar is added on, it can be taken off, and then for brevity's sake, everyone's always in a hurry, even in Cheshvan, so they call it just the month of Cheshvan. But it's possible that is a mistake. However, even if it's a mistake, it has halachic ramifications, as the Poskim point out, because the only time it's important for us to know exactly what a month is called is on legal documents of all of their types. And you have to get the month right. If you call the month wrong, it could compromise the integrity of the shtar, of the document. The Aruch HaShulchan in Evin Ezer states that even though in his opinion the name of the month is really Mar Cheshvan, having said that, it is such a widespread notion that Mar was added on, and therefore it is so widespread that some people just refer to the month as Cheshvan. Therefore, he rules that if there was a halachic or legal document that was dated so-and-so in the month of Cheshvan, it's valid. It's not considered a mistake because everyone knows that Cheshvan, that's what the month is called, even if it's not entirely accurate. I'll just conclude this brief discussion of Cheshvan or Mar Cheshvan with two interpretations. One of Mar Cheshvan is two words and one of Mar Cheshvan with one. If Mar Cheshvan is two words, and Mar means bitter, and that's really the commonly accepted understanding, but one of the early Acharonim, the Pri Chodesh, Rabbi Chizkiya de Silva, in his commentary on Shulchan Aruch, he actually gives a very positive, he's Dorish Lishvach, if we can borrow an expression from Rashi in the Parsha, as two words, Mar Cheshvan. What is the meaning of the word Mar? Well, typically it means bitter. However, says the Pri Chodesh, Mar also means drops of water. How so? The Pasuk says in Yishai, it's one of the Haftarahs for the Shiva de Nechemta, Hein Hagoyim Kemar Midli, all the nations of the world, they're Mar Midli. And what is Mar? Drops of water, like a drop from a bucket. And therefore, says the Pri Chodesh, it could be that it is two words, but Mar Cheshvan doesn't mean bitter Cheshvan, it means drops of water Cheshvan, because it's the beginning of the rainy season, and therefore it's actually a Simon Bracha, one could say. Mar Cheshvan. The final interpretation, and couldn't be more appropriate than to finish with a Hasidic vort, a Hasidic interpretation, and in fact, I'm not entirely sure which Hasidic master says this, which for me actually only makes it more Hasidic. But the Rebbe says, and it's a very beautiful idea, the term Mar Cheshvan actually appears in the Talmud. The Gemara states, we'll not go into the halach details and the context, but the Gemara states that when a person is davening, so sometimes there's the official end time for davening, but then he kind of finishes up. Even once a person's almost like formally concluded his davening, he still just has a few things to say. And that concept is called merachashvan svasaihu. His lips are still mumbling, his lips are still uttering, he's just finishing up all the PS's of his davening. Merachashvan. And actually, according to some, the correct pronunciation of this month is not Mar Cheshvan, but merachashvan. In any case. So the Hasidim say that's exactly what this month is. It really takes us back into the year. We've had the month of Tishrei, and Tishrei has so many big days in it, and it's got Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur, and Sukkot, and so much is going on. And now the critical question, as always, is that to be left behind, or is it to be carried into the year somehow? Is it to be implemented and formatted, and to become and inform the year? And thus, the month after Tishrei says, you've had the month of Tishrei, keep going. Merach HaShivan, you should keep on as surely as it sustains in that way, and has a certain staying power. People should continue to talk about the things during the year that they spoke about during Tishrei. Merach HaShivan, they should keep the conversation going, as they say. So these are some basic comments which I thought to be certainly of topical interest in Main Achshav Emosai. And with that, let us open the Parsha of Noach. Now, the situation at the time of Noach was absolute chaos. To borrow the expression from the Irish, the world was in a state of chassis. And the Pasuk states, in the beginning of the Parsha, in Perek Vav Pasuk Yud Gimel, we have to see the words and note Chazal's understanding of this. Pasuk Yud Beis, Vayar Elokim Es Haaretz V'hinei Nishchasa, Hashem saw the world, it was corrupt. Ki Hishchis Kol Basar Es Darko Ala Aretz. Literally translated, every flesh or all of flesh had corrupted its way in the world. And Rashi quotes briefly from Chazal, it means that there were no boundaries at all, even animals were intermating, not just people. And that, of course, takes some understanding. In other words, it's disappointing when people make the wrong decision, but it's understandable because it can happen. People can make the wrong decision. It's harder to understand how an animal can do something like that. An animal has its nature, and that's that. Later on, we should note, just for the broader discussion, for the record, later on, when Hashem says that He's going to destroy everything, every living thing, we have what appears to be a conflicting idea. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, and it's in Perek Chelek of Sanhedrin, which discusses all of Parshas Noach, or these parts of Noach, the Gemara raises the question, why is everything to be destroyed? Listen, man may have been doing the wrong thing, but no one else is. Nothing else is. Why is everything destroyed? Im Adam Chata, Behema Machata. Okay, the man took a wrong turn. Everyone else seems to be okay. So why is everything to be destroyed? And the Gemara explains this matter with a mashal. It's a very, very difficult mashal of a person. His son was to be married, and he created a whole chuppah for the occasion. And then, lo aleinu, the son dies before the wedding. And the person, he starts dismantling the chuppah, this father. And people say to him, well, it's a nice chuppah. What did the chuppah ever do wrong? But he says, but it's all for him. If he's not here, then there's nothing. And so too says the Gemara, listen, maybe only man sinned, but if there's no man, so what's everything else doing here? Everything else is the chuppah for man. So what's interesting to note, as the Maharsha points out, this doesn't really seem to be going in the same direction as the first. The first really saw, you know, wrongdoing on all levels of life. And this one seems to have restricted it to man. And that's what we call agados, halukos, different agados, different directions, different approaches and different opinions. Okay. But we will come back to that to those agadas. There is a medrash which is quite striking. And it relates to the pasuk which we have in our siddur, va'ani v'rov chastecha avoveisecha, ishtacha v'echalecha kodshecha b'yirasecha. The first part of that pasuk, va'ani v'rov chastecha avoveisecha. Now what's interesting is, we don't perhaps normally note or take note of the fact that that pasuk starts with a vav, which literally means, and me. But that's an unusual way to start something. You can't start by saying and. So if you get to shul, v'ani v'rov chastecha avoveisecha, and me. Me and who? I'm the first one mentioned. How can I be and? First thing in the morning is not always the time to think about these things. The chazan is already a few leagues ahead. but it is a shaila. And that's why the common translation in the siddur, if we see how the vav is rendered, and a vav can really mean more than one thing, the va'ani is rendered as for me. Va'ani, as for me. And the question is almost neutralized in that way. Interestingly, in context, the vav may mean and. In context meaning in Tehillim itself. This pasuk is from Tehillim, Perek Vav. And what pasuk precedes it? The pasuk states, Te'abed, with an aleph, like Lashmid, Larok, or La'abed. The pasuk says to Hashem, Te'abed, you will destroy Dovrei Kozov, those who speak falsehood. Meaning, and those who are false people. And the Medrash Bereishis Rabba says, that's the generation of the flood. They were false, their words were false, everything about them was corrupt, and Hashem destroyed them. Ta'abei dovrei kazov. And the next pasuk says, va'ani. And very carefully, with the medrash, we approach that word, and it says, and me. And here are the words of the medrash. Va'ani, and me. Ka'asher osu, kein osisi. Just like they did, so did I. That's what va'ani means. Who are the subjects of the first pasuk? False people. And Noah says, and me. I also was not beseder. Them and me. Now you may say, so then why am I in the ark and they're outside? If we're the same. Uma bini levinam. So what's the difference between them and me? Ella says, Noah, this is referring to Noah, according to the Medrash. Gemaltani chesed, you did a kindness. Vani vro chastacha, you did a kindness, and you told me to come to the ark. Now, that's the Midrash. Very, very difficult Midrash. Certainly nothing like anything that we see as we go through the Mefarshim. We understand that Noach is a tzaddik. Now, he may be a tzaddik, even those who are Derish Lignai, even those who take maybe a more critical view of Noach, but he's still a tzaddik vis-a-vis his generation. He's not like them. You could say maybe he wouldn't stand up to Abraham. You can say that if you want, and some people do. But he's not like his generation. Relative to them, the Pasuk says black and white he's a tzaddik. So how can Noah contradict the Pasuk? The Pasuk says he's a tzaddik on some fundamental level, and he says he's the same as everyone else. And moreover, if we really take Noah at his word, and let us say that maybe he's being extremely humble or self-effacing, but if we take him at his word, and therefore he says, so what's the difference between them and me? Because you did me a kindness. But let's press the question. But why did Hashem do a kindness with you? If you're the same as them, so then it seems random. It's also most interesting to note in this, that according to the Midrash, the Teva, Noah's Ark, has the designation of Hashem's house. Because if we follow through the Pasuk, Va'ani, I'm like them, Berov Chastacha, you did a kindness with me, Avo Besecha, I came to your house. That's a very interesting idea. I don't think we ever think about Tevas Noach as being Hashem's house. When we think of the concept of Hashem's house, we think of the Beis HaMikdash first and foremost, and then by extension Shul, that's Beis Hashem. Shivti Beis Hashem, that's Beis Hashem. But Noah's Ark, I think we normally say belongs to Noah. I mean, that's why we call it Noah's Ark. And it's called Tevas Noach. But Noah says it belongs to Hashem. But in what way? And how is that relevant to this discussion? So these are some basic questions. Of course, there's so much in Noah, one has to start somewhere. And I would like to preface the approach that the Beis Halevi will take. And we only have Beis Halevi and Chumash Brachos and Shemos, so we have to chaperayim. And the Beis Halevi writes about this at length. And the questions that we raised are the Beis Halevi's questions. In preface to his answer, I would like to devote a few moments to discussing a concept that is very interesting because it seems to be a very central concept, but it can very easily go undiscussed, even by people who lead good Jewish lives and learn Torah. And that is the concept of Tzelem Elokim. It's a very elusive concept, and maybe that's why it's easier to leave it alone. But the Pasuk says that man is created B'Tzelem Elokim. Chaviv Adam, Shinivra B'Tzelem. And the question, of course, is, what does this mean? What is the meaning that man is B'Tzelem Elokim? Obviously, it cannot mean physically that man physically resembles Hashem because Ein lo tumus haguf ve'ein lo guf. So it must refer to a likeness of a certain property. What is that property that man is tselem of, that he has a likeness of? And this question, as we can appreciate, is discussed throughout the ages, from Rishonim to Achronim, and there are a number of opinions. The Rambam states, for example, that tselem elokim refers to the faculty of abstract thought, as if to say, other living beings have thoughts, but they don't have contemplative or abstract thoughts. That's reserved for man, and in that respect, man is B'Tzelem Elokim. That's the Rambam in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah. Others say it refers to the faculty of Bechira, or free will. But this question is discussed at length by Reb Chaim Volozhin in the beginning of his major sefer, Nefesh HaChaim. It is literally the first discussion. Sha'ar Aleph, Perek Aleph. What is Tzelem Elokim? The sefer Nefesh HaChaim, as we know, was written by Reb Chaim Volozhin, one of the primary disciples of the Vilna Gaon, as a response to where he felt that Hasidus went wrong in their thought. Primarily, it's a response to the sefer Tanya, but also to many other numerous other Hasidic masters and works. And he begins with Tzelem Elokim. Says Reb Chaim of Volozhin, in order to understand what Tselem Elokim means, we must first establish what the word Elokim means, because you need to know what Elokim is and then know what a likeness of that is. Who is the first one to discuss, or where do we find a major discussion of the meaning of the term Elokim? It's actually a halachic discussion, for the simple reason that the halacha states, when you say Hashem's name, you should know what you mean. And therefore, the Tur and the Shulchan Aruch in Aruch Chaim Siman Hei have sections as to what is the meaning of the name Yud Kei Vav Kei, and what's Aleph Talat Nun Yud, and what is Elokim. And the Tur, who is then codified by the Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Shulchan Aruch, states that Elokim refers to Hashem as Baal HaKochos Kulam. Baal HaKochos Kulam means that the truth is that the word Elohim means a force, or a source of power, or an entity of power. And that's why we find, and it's important to note, that the word Elohim is used in Tanakh, in Chumash and Tanakh, even when it doesn't refer to Hashem. And in those cases, it should be pronounced Elohim, not Elokim. It's wrong to call it Elokim, because Elokim is respect for when it refers to Hashem. But when it doesn't refer to Hashem, it is not correct to give it that respect. Who is called Elohim? The judge is called Elohim three times in Parshas Mishpatim. V'nikrav balabais Elo Elohim. And why is he called Elohim? Because he's powerful. He's authority. He has the authority of the Besdin. Malachim are called Elohim. They have power. The power given to them by Hashem, but they have power. They are his emissaries. And thus we find that a malach would be called Elohim. Yaakov is met by two groups of angels. And he says, Machane Elohimze, and so on and so forth. But the source of all of this is Hashem himself, Elohim. And we say that he is Elokei HaElohim. That is the correct way to say it. He is the force amongst all the other forces, because they get their power from him. Elokei HaElohim. If that's the meaning of the word Elokim, that Hashem is the power behind all other powers, then what is the meaning of Tselem Elohim? Tselem Elokim means, and this is a profound in the extreme, Tselem Elokim means that Hashem is the actual, is the essential power behind all powers, behind all forces, but he has bestowed a likeness of that power to man. And what that means is that it's ultimately HaKadosh Baruch Hu who is the force behind everything and how it is and what level it is. But he has placed man in executive charge of the well-being of the world. If that's true, then if man is now in charge and the state of the world is dependent on man, then he is now Tselem Elokim. That's his likeness of the actual power that exists by Hashem. He has been entrusted with some of that power. It could be taken away from him at any time, because Hashem is Elokei HaElohim. But things as they are, that is the power with which he has been entrusted. And this is the description which Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, in the first chapter of his Sefer Mesilas Yesharim, he lays it out exactly in that way. And it reverberates really through all of his works. Because really what this idea is saying is that no man is an island, in the sense that no man's deeds are confined merely to himself. When he rises, his surroundings rise. When he falls, his surroundings fall. He's wired into broader existence. And thus, says the Mesilas Yesharim, if a person makes the right choices and does the right thing and acts in the right way, hinei hu mis'ale, he rises, v'ha'olam atzmo mis'ale ima, and the world rises with him. And if he takes a wrong turn, he falls, and the world falls with him. This, one could say, connected way of seeing man's relationship with the world is expressed very, very beautifully by the Ksav Sofer, son of the Chasam Sofer. Ksav Sofer in his Perush on the Torah, where, as we know, throughout the days of creation, every day has the like signature ending with the words Vayar Elokim Ki Tov. On Monday it's missing, and then Tuesday we have it twice, but that's how you know that the Bria for that day has ended. Vayar Elokim Ki Tov. The exception to that is the creation of man. on day six. There are two distinctions. Firstly, it does not say Vayar Elokim Kitov. It says Vayar Elokim Eskol Asher Asa. This is the introduction to Kiddush. Vayar Elokim Eskol Asher Asa V'hine Tov Ma'od. So what that means is that unlike everything else, which was its own thing at that time, and good, obviously, because Hashem created it, man is not looked at by himself. It doesn't say Vayar Elokim Kitov. When man comes on the scene, he will necessarily be looked at in conjunction with everything else, because his state is the state of everything. V'hinei Tov Ma'od means that he has the capacity now to take everything that is inherently Tov and raise it to the level which is called Tov Ma'od. Having said that, he can decline to do so. He can go in the opposite direction, which will have then these ramifications for everything else. That's called Tzelem Elokim. And it's one could say, to describe it in this way, this is really the Torah's spiritual introduction to what we would call environmental awareness. In the same way that people used to believe that all of their actions in all spheres affected only themselves, but now we know that that's not true at all. So that has never been true. And as far as the moral issues and mitzvahs and averos, a person always affects the environment. And Reb Chaim of Volozhin elsewhere, just to give a sense of the reach of man, shall we say, how far does this concept of Tzelem Elokim go? It goes all the way up. In his discussion of Yaakov's ladder, which is his dream in the beginning of Vayetze, and the dream of Yaakov's ladder, we should note, is very interesting. It's unique among dreams in the Torah. How so? Because it's not the only dream in the Torah, but is the only dream which does not have its interpretation in the Torah. Yosef has dreams, but we hear their interpretation. The same is true for Paro's dreams, and the Sarah Mashkim, and Sarah Ophim. But Yaakov has his dream, it's the ladder, and no one ever says what the ladder is, or the pasuk doesn't say. But that's why the Zohar comments enigmatically, and the Zohar says, the ladder is Yaakov. That's the interpretation of the dream. The ladder is Yaakov. The only thing we have to work out now is, what does that mean? Why is Yaakov a ladder? But it says, Reb Chaim of Volozhin, the understanding, or this depiction of Yaakov as a ladder, and Yaakov representing humankind, is that like a ladder, mutzav arza, his feet are on the ground. I mean, he starts down here. But how far does his reach go? All the way up, v'rosha magia hashamayma. It's the same ladder, rung after rung. But that ladder can take a person all the way up. And Yaakov, similarly, his actions here affect things all the way up. To what level? To the highest level. How does the pasuk continue? V'hinei malachei Elokim, behold, malachei Elokim, olim v'yordim bo. We commonly translate the words olim v'yordim bo is that they go up and down the ladder. But Reb Chaim of Volozhin says bo doesn't mean on it. Bo means through it. Meaning, the question of whether the malachim go up or down is dependent on Yaakov. It's all bo. It depends on him. Toloi bo. Interestingly, this idea, just to, as much as we will yet have to return to Earth, but this idea is already referred to, reflected in a most fascinating introduction by Rabbi Arile Bakohen Heller. He's the author of the famous works Ktzosa Choshen and Shav Shmaitza, which are classics in the realms of Choshen Mishpat and Talmud. In his introduction to the Sefer Shav Shmaitza, which he wrote when he was very young. So the Rav Heller says, this is a very interesting medrash. It's actually a Gemara, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, I believe, in the third parak, which refers to Naase Adam, which is last week's parsha. Naase Adam, as we know, it's in the plural. Chazal tell us Hashem consults with the angels. And Rashi quotes that. But we never really hear what the angels said. We just hear that they were consulted. Did they have a say in the matter? What did they respond? But the Gemara gives us the fuller conversation. And the Gemara says that Hashem says, Nase Adam, to the angels. And the angels say, well, if you know, if you're asking, so tell us about him. What's he like? If we're being consulted, so we'd like to be informed. So what's he like? So Hashem started to tell them a bit about man. And the earlier groups of angels said no. It was only later that the angels got it right, so to speak. But the early group said no. So the Chef Schmeitzer of Rav Heller asked in his introduction there, why would they say no? Doesn't sound particularly angelic. Live and let live. So why is it... what is their problem? Okay, so he has his faults. It's his problem. Says Rav Heller, no, it's their problem. That's the point. They understand that if man should enter the picture, he will now be in control of everything, including them. Malachi Elokim, Olam V'Yardim Bo. They are not keen to entrust their well-being to a fickle entity called man. From a certain point of view, you can understand them. And that is the concept now of Tzelem Elokim, the effect that a person has on the world. And it is so worthwhile to ponder. And in fact, there's a fascinating comment of Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, Zatzal, who discusses the well-known case, which is mentioned in the Gemara, in Shabbos, in the second parak, of the prospective convert. He's famous now. He's happy to convert, but apparently he's on a tight schedule, and therefore he wishes to learn the entire Torah on one leg. Gaireini amanas shalmadas kol haTorah kula al regel achas. Okay. As we know, he first visited Shammai, which would not work out well for him. Shammai showed him the door. And from a certain point of view, as Rabbi Yisrael Salanter points out in one of his letters, we should understand Shammai very well. This person is essentially insulting Torah, because really what he's saying is, how much can there be already? I can stand on one leg for, let's say, 30 seconds. I could even have time to spare. I mean, well, how much is there already? And that's an affront to Torah, because there's quite a lot. And therefore, Shammai's Midas Hadin, there's no question about it. But he's very protective of the honor of Torah. If a person insults Torah, then Shammai is the one in Pirkei Avos who says you should receive everyone b'seiv ponim yofos. Everyone deserves to be received b'seiv ponim yofos. They do not deserve to be suffered without end as they insult that which is most important. And at a certain point, Shammai said, it's not acceptable. This person then went to Hillel. Hillel took a different approach. And he winged him in. And Hillel says, okay. Essentially, he said in Aramaic, but the essence of v'ahavta l'recha kamocha. Love your neighbor like yourself. That's it. Probably quite a shock to this person. He actually had time for chazara while he's still on one leg there. But Hillel said to him, that's the whole Torah. Now, there is more. Plenty more, but everything else is commentary. So you ask for it, this is it. Everything else, commentary. Okay, now go learn. I'm not sure if we know whether this person actually converted after that. I don't know. But in any case, that was Hillel's response. And Rashi already raises a very simple question. Namely, V'ahavta l'recha kamocha. It is a pillar of Torah. But it's not the whole Torah. It is roughly half of Torah, for the simple reason that the mitzvahs of Torah are divided into the two domains of Ben Adam Lamakom, Ben Adam Lachaver, between man and man, between man and God. V'ahavta l'recha kamocha, one could safely say, covers all of Ben Adam Lachaver. But there's a whole realm called Ben Adam Lamakom. He hasn't touched that. You need the other leg for that one. So how can you present half of the Torah as all of the Torah? That's a very basic question. Rashi's answer there actually is stunning. Right? Rashi often is looked upon as the simple approach, and everyone else says things that are a bit more. Rashi there says, based on a pasuk in Mishlei, Hashem is also your friend. He should be treated no less than with the courtesy that you treat your friend. You don't want him to ignore you, so don't ignore him. It's all of Torah. That's what Rashi says. What a thing to say. People have been reeling from that Rashi ever since. But Rabbi Chanan Wasserman says, based on the idea that we are developing Tzelem Elokim, and the truth is, all of Torah can be encapsulated in V'Ahavta Kamocha. Because V'Ahavta Kamocha means treat others the way you'd like them to treat you. How would you like them to treat you? Would you like them to ruin the world for you? Or would you like them to enhance the world for you? You'd like them to make the world a better place for you. Make it a better place for them. How can you do that? 248 ways. All of them will have that effect. Even the mitzvah ben Adam la'makom enhances the world. That's Tzelem Elokim. You don't want them to corrupt the world for you. You don't want them to ruin the world. Don't ruin it for them. How could a person ruin the world? There's 365 ways. And some have been Adam la'makom, and some have been Adam la'chaveru. But essentially, the idea that take care of the world for others, because you would want them to take care of them for you, taking care of the world encapsulates all 613. It's the entire Torah on one leg. Returning to lower realms, says the Beis Halevi, here we are stating, or more correctly, we prefaced and now we're about to rejoin him. We have discussed, and it really does stretch the mind, we've discussed how a person's actions, they can affect the state of many realms. They can also affect, says the Beis Halevi, the state of affairs around him and the nature of things around him. And that, says Beis Halevi, will answer our opening question as to how it could be that the animals were acting in a way which was not in accordance with their nature. As if to say, our question was, well, an animal can't make that choice. An animal can only follow its nature. That remains true. The animals change their course because their nature changed its course. But how can they do that? They didn't do it. Man did it. In other words, in the process of corrupting his own nature, he corrupted all spheres of nature, including the nature of animals and beyond. And that, says Beis Halevi, is number one, the understanding of how it could happen. But with that understanding, this is no longer a contradiction to that other Gemara about the chuppah. That other Gemara, which raised the question, when Hashem says, I'm going to destroy everything. And the Gemara asked, well, why are you destroying everything? Man may have sinned, no one else sinned. And earlier Mefarshim pointed out, no one else sinned. Everyone sinned. Says the Beis Halevi, everyone acted in an unusual way, but it was only sin as far as man was concerned. Because it was only man that made the wrong choice. It was only man that chose against his better nature. An animal can only follow its nature. As a result of him corrupting his nature, everything changed. But that's not called a sin. They don't deserve punishment for wrongdoing. They didn't do anything wrong. Their nature had been changed for them. Or perhaps if we could put it maybe more succinctly, the difference between the change in man and the change in animals is that man had become corrupt. Animals had become corrupted. That's the difference between them. But when it comes to punishment, one punishes the corrupt, not something which has merely been affected by that. And therefore, says Beis Halevi, there's no lack of harmony between those two, between the idea that the animals were mating outside of their species, but were not considered to be culpable for that. Their nature changed as a result of man's bad choices. And the final stage of this discussion takes us closer to home. For now, we raise a very delicate question. And that is, if it's possible for a person or society that corrupts its nature, that can even corrupt the nature of other living beings, can they corrupt the nature of other people? And specifically, can they corrupt the nature of other people who, without this corrupting influence, without this, which is cosmic in nature, would not have been corrupted, but now they are because it's in the air. Because, and it says the Beis Halevi, they can. If they can corrupt the nature of animals, every person has an animal side to them. And that can also become corrupted. And that, says Beis Halevi, is what happened to Noah. And this is why we have to phrase it very carefully. We don't want to say anything that's not faithful to what the Medrash is saying or the Beis Halevi is saying. But the point is, here's Noah. And Noah seems to make this outrageous statement. Va'ani, back to that pasuk in Tehillim. Their faults, meaning they did all wrong things, and so did me, so did I, va'ani. And our question was, but the pasuk calls him a tzaddik. So what does this mean? What it means is, he was a tzaddik. And were it not for his generation, he would have remained a perfect tzaddik. Not incapable of mistake, but certainly not of those sorts of things. But he was not immune to the influence of his generation, because they corrupted the nature of every living thing, and Noah was a living thing. And that's the Vav, the Ani. The Medrash does not elaborate, and therefore we don't have license to speculate to what degree was Noah in guilty of these things. We can assume it wasn't to a very great degree. The Pasuk calls him a tzaddik tamim, but he wasn't immune to it. He didn't brush it off like it was nothing. It affected him because he was alive in that world. And that's the meaning of that Medrash of Va'ani. Interestingly, in this regard, we find that Noah is contrasted with a specific individual, Avram Avinu. Those who are Dorish Lignai, they see this pasuk as critical, being critical of Noah. What that means is that in his generation he was a tzaddik, but he would not have been considered a tzaddik if he was in the generation of Avram. But why is Avram singled out? Because, says Beis Halevi, from a certain point of view, Avram was very similar to Noah. They both lived in a time where everyone around them was corrupt. But see the difference. Avram was able to allow it not to affect him. In that respect, Avram is compared favorably with Noah. Noah is compared unfavorably with Avram. In other words, we find that Avram is also, everyone around him, there's Avodah Zarah and there's immorality, but he emerges as Avram. In spite of all that. And interestingly, that is the meaning, according to some, of the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, which compares the 10 generations from Adam to Noah, and then from Noah to Avram. But there's a different ending of those two sentences. 10 generations from Adam to Noah, to teach you how patient is, because there was 10 generations, and then Hashem didn't destroy them until number 10. When there's 10 generations from Noah to Avram, they're also degenerating. But the end of the sentence is to teach you how beloved Avram is, that they were all machisin uvoim until Avram came, v'kibas harkulam, and he received reward of all of them. Now the question is, why should Avram receive the reward of all of them? It's not as simple as, well, there's reward available, they didn't take it, so it's hefker, so Avram can pick it up, because no one else is really deserving it. A person gets reward for their actions. Why would he get reward for them? But the Mefarshim explain, when it says he got reward for them, it means his reward was greater because of each and every one of those other people who made it harder for him to be Avram. Because they corrupted the world. And Lefum Tzara Agra, a person's reward is commensurate with the effort. It took Avram more effort to be Avram in the way that he was, in light of the fact that the world had steadily been corrupted by 10 generations, and therefore he receives reward equivalent to all of those people who made it that much more difficult for him. But coming back to Noah, we can now understand, perhaps on a deeper level, what the Teva represents. Because Noah said, what is the difference between them and me? You were kind to me. It wasn't a random kindness. Otherwise, the question would be, well, why was he kind to you? There was a reason Hashem was kind to Noah. Because if Noah can only be removed, if he can only be somehow vouchsafed or distanced, placed beyond reach of that corruptive influence, he'll be Noah. None of the other, everyone else is self-made. They've made their choices. But Noah has been affected by it. But if Noah was somehow affected because he was in a bad environment, so what is the antidote? What's the solution to place him in a good environment. What's a good environment? Hashem's house. That's the teva. That's why he refers to the teva as aniver of chastacha of obesecha. It wasn't just a place that he would be safe and survive the flood. It's a place that he could be rehabilitated because it was the ultimate positive environment. If the negative environment is when the world that he shares with the generation of the flood, the positive environment is the teva that he shares with Hashem because the Shekhinah was there. And that's why that was the kindness. The kindness was to place Noah in the environment that would bring out the best in him. And interestingly, there is a parallel medrash which comments on the pasuk elsewhere in Tehillim: Shesulim beveis Hashem, planted or transplanted in Hashem's house. Says the medrash, that's Noah and his family, transplanted into Hashem's house. What's Hashem's house? The teva, because that's where the Shechina was. But why are they called Shesulim? So the Shem Yishmuel of Sokotrov says, a plant draws sustenance from its roots. So depending on where it's rooted, that will determine how it will grow. When something is transplanted, it is literally uprooted from its original location where it was drawing a certain type of sustenance and is placed somewhere else where it can draw a different type of sustenance. That's exactly Noah. Everyone draws on their environment. And Noah was drawing on a negative environment, and then he became transplanted. Shesulim beBeis Hashem. And now he's rooted in Beis Hashem. Again, it doesn't mean that as long as the person is alive, there is no guarantee that they will not make a mistake. But in terms of a tendency in that way, that for that Noah was healed. So this is the very major discussion of the Beis Halevi, which relates to so many of these basic questions with regards to Noah. Just a final comment, and I came across it in the Meshech Chochma, towards the end of the Parsha. It's a rather enigmatic, again, comment of the Medrash. The Medrash here compares Noach with Moshe in a very specific way. This is Bereishis Rabba, Parsha Lamed Vav. Amar Rav Berechia, Chaviv Moshe Minoach. Moshe was more beloved than Noach. How do we see this? So these are the words of the Medrash. Noach, consider Noach. Mishenikra ish tzadik, nikra ish adama. You see that perhaps the easiest way to translate this is you see that he went from being called an ish tzadik in the beginning of the parsha to being called ish adama towards the end, which he was. He planted that vineyard and whatever happened, happened. So, and the Medrash sees this as a there's a connection between these two, and it's a downward trajectory. Contrast that, says Medrash, Moshe, mishenikra ish mitzri, nikra ish elokim. Contrast that with Moshe, the first thing that Moshe is ever called is the ish mitzri, which hardly is the most greatest distinction. But then by the time he's finished, he's called ish elokim, which is the upward trajectory. Now, the question is, what is it? It can mean so many things. We need guidance in a medrash like this. But the Meshech Chochma explains that really the point that divides them is the question of their relationship and their attentiveness and their care for their surroundings. And what that means is, says Meshech Chochma, there exists a tendency, and perhaps it's intuitive, it's understandable, that if a person wishes to develop in terms of their spiritual well-being, and if a person wishes to develop in terms of their relationship with Hashem, if a person wishes to develop in terms of their status, they would be best closeted alone between them and Hashem, because other people tend to get in the way at best. And as soon as the person becomes involved in community matters and the welfare of others, it's very nice. But he, in a sense, he is detracting from his focus that otherwise would have led him straight to Hashem. And the truth is, says Meshech Chochma, the point of this medrash is to teach us the exact opposite. Because you see that Noach in the beginning, it was really just him and Hashem in the sense that he wasn't really involved in the people of his generation. And as we know, there's much to discuss about that. It's not a simple discussion, but the fact is that it was basically him by himself. And he began as Ishar Akim, just him communing, connecting directly with Hashem. Says the Meshech Chochma, that led him downwards. He didn't get nachas from that approach, and by the time he's finished his Ishar Dama. Look at Moshe Rabbeinu. He begins his career, so to speak, or his first appellation, is Ish Mitzri. It's not a great distinction. He wasn't in a great... He's a refugee, Egyptian refugee. But what had he done, and why was he a refugee? He put himself out for another Jew. He'd spoken up. There was injustice. Ish Mitzri spoke up for him, and they spoke up again. He put himself out for people. And he began in trouble, but by the time he's finished, he's an Ish Elokim, and he's an Ish Elokim for that reason, says Meshech Chochma. And it's a major idea that, and clearly it's not an either or, but the point is that investing in the well-being of others, investing in the well-being of the Jewish people, on paper, it detracts from a person's religious pursuits because they might need just very basic things, very mundane things. But Moshe Rabbeinu did very well by it. And he became Ish Elokim. And he was just saving a person who was being oppressed, and he spoke up for him, and he suffered for it, and he was on the run for it. And that was the beginning of an upward trajectory for him. And I believe that this comment of Meshech Chochma, it lines up with another idea of his elsewhere, which needs to be explored further, but just to mention the idea. I came across the most fascinating thing. I forget which parsha was in Meshech Chochma, but he talks. It's clear that in his understanding, the concept of Klal Yisrael, of the Jewish people, is exponentially greater than the sum of its parts. With all due respect to the value of each and every Jew, there's a concept called the Jewish people, called Yisrael, and that entity has a connection that no individual can have by himself. And he says this with reference to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. And he says a most amazing thing. We know, Rambam says, and others, that there's a practice. It's a very praiseworthy thing. That in the days of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, people, they give much more tzedakah and involve much more in kindness. And that's a well-known thing. Tshuva tefillah tzedakah. Now the question is why? Seemingly the answer is very simple, because we need merits, and kindness is a great merit, and we want Hashem to be kind to us, and if we're kind to others, there's many, many ways to explain it. But the Meshech Chochma says none of the above. The reason why the minhag is that in these days that a person, he gives tzedakah and he gives kindness, is because through those acts he is connecting himself with the Jewish people. Because the Jewish people are those that are in the safest position in these days of din. And it's the Jewish people that are most entitled to receive the tahara of Yom Kippur. That concept called Yisrael. Who's in? A person who connects themselves. And how does a person connect themselves? By looking out for the welfare of other people in that entity, which is called Yisrael. That's what's behind the idea of acts of kindness and acts of charity. You're investing and you're connecting. And you're identifying and associating with, and you're part of that, and that's the best place that you could be. You're buying into the Jewish people. And what we see from this comment to Noah here is that with regards to Yom Kippur, we saw the Jewish people have a special place in terms of, shall we say, purity and kapara. But here we see that the Jewish people is the place to be in terms of a person's general spiritual path, which will lead him upwards as he invests in the well-being of others. So certainly a very beautiful idea to end off on. We'll leave it over here for this evening. Pick up again next week.